Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for ways to win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Hello and welcome to The Game, 40 minutes of the best football opinion, or otherwise me trying to look after idiots who make no sense. That's for you to decide. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and this week I am fortunate to be joined by a rather unwell Rory K. Smith, a rather sparkling looking Pedro Pinto, and from the Great Northeast, George Culkin. Later we'll be trying to improve the Club World Cup, since, as I understand it, many of you don't like it. But first we'll start with the Premier League. And since George is on board, you guessed it. Let's go straight to sportsdirect.com at St. James Park. Is that what it's called now, George? No, it's got a different name, right?
You're not allowed. Not allowed to call it that anymore. Those good people at Wonga have re-delivered us back to our birthright.
And as part of their sponsorship, Wonga aren't getting their name on the stadium.
That's correct. Wonga allegedly have paid money in order not to have their name associated with something. And if now, you can make sense of that, then you're a better man than I can.
Is this money that...
News. This is old news.
Is this money that Ashley will have to pay back at extortionate interest rates?
Yeah, in 30 days. In 30 days.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's okay, because he was approved over the internet. On to football. George, I'm going to throw you a wobble there because I'm going to ask you. City started with Sergio Aguero and Carlos Tevez, the two little guys who pass and move. They have a tremendous record when they start together. Is this what Pardew was expecting, and were they as devastating in person as they looked on television?
Yeah, I think it's 13 wins, isn't it, when they've started games together. It was great. I mean, I'm based in the North East, so I don't get to see a lot of Man City or Man United or whatever. It was fabulous watching them in that first half after the first 10 minutes when Newcastle sort of had a go. It was just beautiful. The passing and movement was so quick. They were kind of electric. The ball was being moved kind of faster than you could almost keep pace with it at times. It was gorgeous to watch. I mean, it wasn't languid. It was so sort of, what kind of really struck me was sort of how how hard they all worked. I mean, in the first half as an attacking force, and then in the second having to sort of defend, it wasn't faultless, but it did underpin that victory, which, you know, there were obviously accusations in the Manchester derby that not everybody had sort of maybe pulled together in quite the same way, which I found sort of interesting. But I thought they were wonderful to watch in that first half.
Roy, so the obvious question is, why don't these people start every single game? I think I know why. Do you know why?
I hope I know the same thing as you do. I think
is that because we're both sort of pretentious Europhiles?
Well, I'm not a percentage Europhile, and you're not either. You're Italian, so you're allowed to be. You're just being an Italian. It's partly because Mancini's got other options, and you know the days of the same strike partnership starting every game or the same players starting every game are over to an extent. I think that's a huge factor. I think the other thing is that Mancini is inherently a massive paranoiac, and he tries to tailor his teams to suit the opposition as he perceives it, rather than just naming his strongest side and saying, go on, beat that. That, to me, is probably why why Eduardo and Tevez haven't started as often as maybe we would have thought they would. The one thing I don't understand, and you may be able to explain better than me, is why he didn't start them when they are clearly his best strike force in the Manchester derby. I understand why they don't start every week, but I don't understand why you don't start them in your toughest game.
That was a bit of a mystery to me as well. But since you asked, I think it had to do with the fact that he saw Balotelli as somebody who had trained well that week. He knew Balotelli performed very well against United before, and he thought he was the right guy for the job. I don't think it was masochism, but more broadly speaking, I don't think there's any question that in Mancini's perfect world, footballers wouldn't just be talented, they'd also be very good little tactical soldiers. And Tevez isn't, or he doesn't see him as that kind of player. Aguero, yes. And so he opts for different solutions, going with the big man, the athletic man, or the good footballer in Tevez, to partner Aguero. Pedro, is this, in your view, is it just open and shut that those two should be starting and there's really no reason to mess around with Dzeko and the other one?
I think they're the two best strikers. They know each other for many years, playing with Argentina as well, and they're a handful. Because
I'm going to jump in there and ask you a question on the back of that, because you said we're playing with Argentina, right? People always talk about this, oh, look, but they've known each other for years. They played on the national team together. I'd love to know how often Tevez and Aguero played as a strike partnership for Argentina. I would guess that while they were in the same squads all the time, I would guess they very rarely happened. And I don't know, do you really have the benefit when there's another guy with them, obviously Messi, or indeed other people, Milito or whoever else, who kind of wouldn't Messi's presence influence the type of running and everything they do? That wouldn't it be completely different when it's that versus the two of them up front?
I think when you play a similar style of football like both of those do, and when you're in the same squads and you know what the other strike partners' strengths and weaknesses are, that always helps. Whether you're playing in the first 11 every single time or not, you know each other's game very well, and those two guys do, and they get on very well off the pitch as well, and that helps. My personal opinion is those two guys should start every time or nearly every time they're healthy. We know in today's modern football that you need to rotate the squad, you need to keep egos happy. I agree. Both of those guys should have played against United. I think something else which worked for Manchester City this past weekend was the fact that Javi Garcia is back, and he protects Yaya Touré a lot more, and David Silva and Nasri a lot more than someone like Gareth Barry does. And his physical presence in midfield makes a huge difference and just makes that whole team look a lot more compact. Aguero and Tevez for me are two of the best strikers in the league. So yeah, I would always point at both of them to start every game if possible.
Roy, just on the point Pedro made, are you on board with that? And do you think with Touré going to the African Cup of Nations, we'll probably see a lot of Barry and Javi Garcia in the middle of the park? Is that a massive downgrade for City, or do you share
It kind of depends on what you see as Touré's best position. I actually think no one likes Yaya Touré more than me as a footballer and as a man. He's a lovely bloke, his Yaya, but
his missus, perhaps.
I'm not sure what their relationship's like. To be honest, I do like him a lot, and it may be more than his missus likes him. Yaya's not been great this season for City. I don't think that's any great secret. That's not exactly a controversial opinion. They will miss him because I think he has an aura about him, but he's not the player this season that he was last season. The one thing I would say is interesting that Pedro sort of singles out Javi Garcia as being a boon for City that he was back, because it looks like Mancini's not convinced by him. The reason that they sort of spent so long waiting to get him is because Man City didn't think he was good enough. The club didn't think Garcia was good enough. I saw him for Benfica a couple of times and was moderately impressed in a good side. He looked decent. I wouldn't have picked him out as a £16 million signing to strengthen the champions, but he looked like a good player. Mancini wanted other targets, fairly obviously. He wanted De Rossi. He gets Garcia on transfer deadline day. The club aren't convinced. And to be honest, Garcia has not looked that great. He looked a bit too slow, a little bit ponderous for England. That could be, I guess, that he's just adapting. But then if you look at the fact that Mancini seems to be yet again flirting with De Rossi, there's talk of Pedro Obiang from Sampdoria as well. It looks like maybe Mancini's not convinced by Garcia either.
You're saying Garcia is slow, as if Gareth Barry is what exactly? Because when Gareth Barry moves, I don't see anyone else around him.
Torre certainly played really well on Saturday. I mean, whether that was from having Garcia beside him or just the fact that kind of coming back into form. I mean, that's been a sort of something that you can level at quite a few of sort of City's bigger players this season. They've not quite delivered what they did last season, but I mean, there were certainly signs there on Saturday that that was kind of coming back together again.
I watched Match of the Day, and it's whole song and dance about Cisse and Ba needing to be close to each other, otherwise they're not effective. And obviously, from what I've seen by the television, and I've only seen Newcastle once in person this season, he likes to play three up front, and obviously at the weekend there was no Ben Arfa and whatever else. What's your take on this? Is it really that different? I mean, they're two very good players. They don't seem to score in the same game at the same time. Is it really that difficult to get these two to play together and really, you know, kind of have a multiplier effect or have a positive effect on each other?
It has been, yeah. It has.
Why?
Been.
Is it a coaching issue?
They've only 4-4-3-3 this season is a relatively recent development. They started playing 4-4-2, and that certainly wasn't getting the best out of them as a partnership. In fact, you know, they just weren't a partnership, really.
I suspect from what Shearer said on television, though, he prefers seeing them in a 4-4-2 where they can be next to each other.
Yeah, but it just didn't work. And so, I mean,
you'll tell Shearer that then, huh?
As kind of journalists, we were asking Pardew about why he wasn't playing the 4-3-3 that they'd finished last season with, which is when Barr was kind of pushed out to the left and Cisse was scoring all the time through the middle. This time it's been reversed. Barr's been scoring all the goals, and then in the last sort of few games, Cisse got moved out to the right. But kind of Pardew, I mean, almost said that was partially to sort of take the pressure off Cisse a little bit. It's difficult to just look at that one thing in isolation, because the whole team has been misfiring, certainly compared to last time, and key players just haven't been the same players as they were last season. The Barca issue, you know, is a big one, because it hasn't been resolved satisfactorily from day one, really. But you know, you can't sort of take it in isolation from the struggle that's kind of being felt by the rest of them.
I would look elsewhere as well on the Newcastle team, because you can only ask your strikers to finish the chances that are created, and I don't see Newcastle creating as much as they did last year. Whether that's teams not being as surprised by their style of play as they were last year, they're respecting them a lot more, so they're playing deeper, there's less space for Cisse and Ba to operate in. I just think there's a problem there creating chances. And George, maybe if you watch Newcastle certainly a lot more than me, you can tell me if I'm right or wrong.
No, I mean, they've been incredibly reliant on Hassan Ben Arfa this season. He's been the one sort of creative player that you can't criticise. But you know, he's found himself pretty well shackled as well. So they don't have that. You know, they don't kind of have that outlet. And the stats show that they've been kind of resorting to the long ball, you know, I would say far too often this season with the players they've got.
Good thing they gave all those guys those 8-year contracts then, right?
Well, the one interesting thing this season, actually, which is sort of quite encouraging, is that you can argue that sort of in previous seasons, certainly 2 or 3, 4 years ago, 5 years ago, under previous regime even, if a Newcastle sort of manager had been overseeing a spell of six defeats in seven league games, which is what it is now, one win in 10 in all competitions, or one in 11 in all competitions. You know, there would be whispers around the place, and it would kind of come from the top, and it would filter down, and the city would be sort of alive with speculation. We've all seen that before, and it happens very regularly. Now, the one thing that hasn't happened this season is that.
Rory, we have to touch upon Super Mario Balotelli, because he doesn't, even when he doesn't play, he makes headlines. Early crucifixion early on a Match of the Day from Alan Shearer. Even though at that point we didn't know that he was taking legal action against the club. Can you just put this in some kind of broader context for me? Because he was fined, according to James Ducker's excellent piece today, he was fined 2 weeks' wages because he went over the limit in terms of, I guess there's a clause in his contract which says that if you're unavailable through suspension for more than a certain number of games, and because of the three red cards he got last season, he ended up missing more than that number of games, and so they fined him. Now, he's appealing against them. Now, this might be in his contract, but I'm assuming that it's the kind of clause that the club don't have to enforce unless they really want to, right?
Yeah, I would guess so. And I mean, in City's defence, Balotelli was suspended for a quite spectacular number of games last season because of red cards. It's incredible that he missed more than 20. I think James writes that he missed more than 20% of the season because of being sent off, which is a huge amount. And you understand why City would fine him 2 weeks' wages for that.
Okay, and since obviously nobody will stick up for Mario, then I will.
I'm not anti-Mario. I think on that one, you can't excuse it. Right. Even take the Scott Parker thing, if it was completely an accident that he kicked Scott Parker in the head, he obviously hasn't learned from that, and I think City have a right to try and discipline him, to say, look, there are consequences for these actions. I think what this is, and it's what James has written today, Balotelli's time at City is at an end, rightly or wrongly, whether he is the sort of the superstar that all of the managers who've worked with him think he can be, or the fairly average, half-decent on occasion footballer that I've seen. We don't know, but I suspect his time at City now, if they can find a buyer, is at an end, because it seems to be the case now that he is not worth the bother that comes with him. That is kind of empirically true now, and I think Mancini seems to have made that decision. Although, him and Mancini, I guess, is that he can always change his mind all the time.
Well, you just look at the kind of fundamental role that Carlos Tevez now has in the team and squad, and compare that to what happened last season, where he'd been, you know, he'd been sold and gone and banished several times over, and then, you know, somehow finds himself sort of back in the team. I mean, it does feel like that with Balotelli when you're kind of taking action against your own team. But I'm sure that part of this is just trying to get him to sort of, you know, to apply himself to understand that there have to be sort of not just discipline but sort of self-discipline.
I think those are wise words from George, in the same way that Carlos Tevez looked like he was done and then he came back and proved to be very effective. I don't think we can rule out the possibility that Mario could come back and be very effective. But Pedro, I want to ask you, City's accounts came back last year. They made another enormous loss, but it was less than the loss before. And, you know, I think they feel they could be on track for financial fair play if certain things fall into place. Obviously, Mansour has a lot of money, but it's equally true that because of financial fair play, he's got to spend it wisely, not take a huge loss. If there's a situation where, and I think everybody knows that Balotelli, you want to move him on. If there's a situation where, if you move him on, you know, he's got big wages, you're not going to get a huge fee because his wages are so big. Wouldn't you want to kind of maximize your chances of getting the best possible fee and avoid sort of fining him or annoying him, which will just drive him, which will create a guy you still need to pay, obviously, but is going to be more difficult to shift?
I think there's two different forces at play here. One is Manchester City not really sure of what they can do anymore to control Balotelli, and Mancini can say for so long, it's okay, I know him, it's okay, I know him, it's okay, I know him, I know how to deal with him. Well, I don't think he does know how to deal with him, and I think the club has stepped in and tried to make make a point and to show him who's boss, so to speak. Is that the best possible way to deal with Balotelli? No, I think they should have had a more intelligent stance perhaps earlier, shortly after he went to Manchester City. The other situation is that Balotelli has been a PR disaster, and his agent, Mino Raiola, just does not know how to control him either, because whether you like it or not, whether he's a talented footballer or not, his brand has been damaged. And I don't know if there's anything he can do here in the Premier League to change that. They will make a loss when they sell him. I know from people close to the club that they are shopping him around in January. They're trying to move him to Inter, to Milan, to Juve. They're trying to get some kind of money for him. You're right, there's a huge issue with the ages, with the wages, but there's two different forces here. I don't know who's going to win. I think Balotelli can only win if he realizes he has a problem. And if he doesn't realize that, he's not going to change, and his career could be affected forever.
Wouldn't be the Game podcast without talking about Liverpool, of course, would it? Liverpool and Villa. Now, Pedro, riddle me this, okay? They say that you can't really play well in the Premier League in English football with a three-man defense, because three-man defenses are done. Of course, we know that you win nothing with kids and you can't throw in inexperienced people. And there's no bargains in the transfer window. Who could you possibly buy for £7 million? Okay, so here's Aston Villa. Horrible, horrible start to the season. Shoestring budget. All these veteran, experienced players on enormous wages, most of whom bite the big one. Yes, I'm talking about you, Stephen Ireland and Zoltan and so on. Darren Bent, I'm a bit more understanding of. Paul Lambert, or Lambert, as we like to call him when he does well, he goes out with a three-man defense with all these dudes who nobody, people either hadn't heard of or were playing goodness knows where, and your Bakers and your Westwoods and your Lehighs. And they're all kids. Everybody in the starting lineup was age 24 or younger, except for Holman, but of course he's Australian, and the goalkeeper, Guzan. And they go and they win at Anfield. And Christian Benteke, they go, you can't get a bargain. £7 million, he looks like the real deal. How impressed are you?
I'll be more impressed if they can do it more often than just once. Benteke is a great player, all right?
Liverpool, I think their entire starting 11 makes less money than you, Pedro. Seriously.
That's not an accurate statement. I'm impressed by the result.
It makes less money than me, then.
I'm impressed by the result. Am I impressed about the team because they had one good game?
No. Are you impressed with what he's done?
In one game.
No. First of all, they've had a very good run, haven't
they?
They
haven't lost in five.
Right? Yeah. The winning at Anfield is kind of the best result they've had, but they've improved substantially recently. They had that really nasty start.
I think in the last 2 months, the only teams that have beaten them in the league are City and United, right? That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's not bad going at all. But no one is a bigger fan of Paul Lambert than me.
Hang on, no one's a bigger fan of Yaya Toure than you. No one's a bigger fan of
exactly. We haven't even mentioned Luis Suarez yet.
Leave a man for the rest of us.
George, I'm a very positive person. I can't help it. It's just nice. I just support people in general.
Benteke is a very good player. He's a solid striker. There's no doubt about it. These guys worked for each other. They worked for each other this weekend. They're stronger. Lambert is a very good manager. So they're going to get better, but it's still a very average team. The three-man defense, if you work on it in training during the week, it will work. A lot of people criticize it because it's kind of a plan B or C or D that really is not invested in training, with hours of players going through positioning and different situations. So I'm very impressed by the result. I'm impressed that they're better, but I don't know what else. Like, do you want me to praise them for
small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall? Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Being amazing?
Well, no, I think if at the start of the season we had sat down and said, all right, what is their likely starting 11? We would have had people like Dunn in there. We would have had Flaher in there, who of course is injured now. We would have had we would have had Darren Bent in there. We would have had all these people in there who aren't playing. And I think it's remarkable for a new manager to go in, have such a horrid start, especially a guy who's, you know, not exactly Mr. Smiley out there, and Paul Lambert, and not exactly Mr. Man of the People, to go and put all those veterans to one side, some by choice, some not by choice, perhaps, and go and show that you can do things with kids. You can do kids things with like people like Westwood, who, you know, was in the lower divisions. Hey, George, hey, can you help me? Can you show some love for Paul Lambert, since nobody seems to be? Is he showing us that there is a different way?
Well, I suppose he is, yeah. And they've got some good young players there, and a lot of those young players have been kind of together, have risen up at the club together as well. So, you know, there is a level of understanding there, and that's, you know, that's showing kind of continuity to what's happening at Villa. I mean, I find the Darren Bent thing perplexing, because yes, they've had a good run, they're in the semi-final of the League Cup, so on and so forth, they've had a very good week, but they are 14th in the table. They've had real problems this season, and Lambert has kind of purposely banished a player who, I know he's injured now, and he's been injured for stretches, who specialises in scoring goals and has, you know, did at Sunderland, basically kept Sunderland up, not single-handedly, but his goals certainly did. And I find that peculiar in terms of man management and in terms of kind of cutting those off, right, despite the face a little bit. It's pretty brave of Lambert, you have to say. And you know, fair play in that regard, but it's pretty early on in the season, and they're not like they're fourth and fifth in the table. They're 14th, and they're not out of trouble.
Where's Lanzi when you need him?
George may know better than me, but the weird thing about the Bent situation is that there doesn't seem to be an explanation for
it. There's not. There hasn't been one to him. So why should there be for the rest of us in some ways? I mean, my kind of understanding is that he's not been sort of told. There hasn't been a bust up. He hasn't been told what he's doing wrong. He hasn't been told how to get back in the team, and he hasn't been told he can kind of go. That's my understanding of it, which just seems a bit strange to sort of alienate a player of that calibre in terms of scoring goals. However well Benteke has done, and obviously he's been very good.
Do you remember why Bent left Sunderland in the first place? I'm sure you do.
Yes.
Okay, let's leave it at that. What do you make of the road that Liverpool are on thus far this year? Because to be fair, we thought of Brendan is this big dogmatic guy, but you know, he's found a space for Shelvey in the top three. He's tweaked things a little bit. You know, it's not the same sort of, you know, Ayatollah 4-3-3 that we saw in years past.
I have no shame in admitting when I look at Liverpool's season, I'm completely lost. I have no idea what's going on. I don't know how good they are. I don't know how bad they are, and I don't. Because some days they'll turn up and Suarez will be fantastic, and then they say, oh, look, Liverpool's only about Suarez. And other days the team will be decent and Suarez will be poor. And then they'll say, oh, but there's a future here. Look, they scored without Suarez or whatever it may be. I don't think there's a lot of raw material there at Liverpool as far as skill is concerned. So I think it's difficult for Brendan Rodgers to really implement a fast pace passing game when there aren't that many amazingly skilled players there. I think they're in a transition period. It's going to take a while. They need to get more bodies in there. They need to get a backup a striker. And I really don't expect them to do much this year. They should be a lot better than they are, let's face it, because they still are Liverpool and that they still have a better squad than a lot of the other teams out there. But I'm lost. I don't know what's going on up there, to be honest.
One competition I find really interesting, and we're actually get excited every year, is the Club World Cup, because I get to see teams from other parts of the world that you don't get to see very often. And we had the underdog, brave, plucky Chelsea taking on Brazilian giants Corinthians and nearly pulling off an unlikely upset in the final. Rory, I want to start with you. It's the age-old thing about, do people care about this tournament? Do they not care about this tournament? In the drive over with Pedro in the car, I suggested that perhaps part of the reason this tournament doesn't capture the imagination the way it does in other countries is that you don't have a great historic legacy that everybody talks about. You were in the Intercontinental Cup final before, of course, but, you know, whereas, for example, in Italy, the AC Milan playing Pele Santos in 63 is part of lore, I'm assuming. Benfica, whoever they played, was big in Portugal. And here in England, it's kind of like when Liverpool won the FA, won the European Cup and went out there, they kind of made it a point of sort of flying out the day before and landing there and being jet-lagged and hitting the bar in the golf course and then, you know, playing Flamengo and getting whooped 4-0. So it's not really part of any great historic sort of shared shared moment. Am I onto something?
Yes.
Thank you.
That's the sort of, to me anyway, that's the kind of defining narrative of English football, is that sometimes, almost randomly, English football decides it doesn't really care about something and then proceeds to pretend it's not important. The rest, there's this idea that, oh, it means more to the South Americans than the Europeans. That may be the case, but from what I remember of seeing, you know, knowing that Massimo Moratti made it, that was the trophy he really wanted to win because his dad did when he was in charge of Inter, seeing Pep Guardiola in tears in Abu Dhabi after Barcelona won the Club World Cup. It's a competition that matters in the rest of Europe. It is just the English who've decided that it's not important. Now why that is, I have literally no idea. Well, the United fans, when they won it, seemed to take great delight in chanting they were the champions of the world. And surely, although it's the competition itself is flawed, surely that is a title that you want, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I compare it to the FA Cup, and you know when the third cup draw comes out and people start writing down, like, not the interesting stuff, like whichever non-league team is playing Manchester United, but like, no, ooh, look, Rochdale against Torquay, how interesting, like when they play each other in the league, and it's like, who cares? But then I realize, like, this is part of your history and the shared legacy and Ricky George and all that stuff, right, Pedro? I mean, we as foreigners, we respect that, and we acknowledge that.
Yeah, I do feel the Intercontinental Cup has huge history in continental Europe. Even when Portuguese teams didn't play, I many times stayed up late or early, whatever way you want to look at it. I remember an amazing game between Boca Juniors and Real Madrid when Juan Román Riquelme was just incredible. I think this is a great competition. It has one thing against it for the European market, which is the time difference. A lot of those years in Tokyo. And in Japan, it's moving to Morocco next year, so hopefully that'll help. I mean, you look at the Europa League, and it's a really big deal when other teams from other countries win it. It's just seen as a secondary competition here because of the money and because it's not as big as an FA Cup, for example. It's a cultural issue, and I mean, I'm not going to be the one to explain that. All I can tell you is that abroad, it's a huge thing to win.
Not that getting too sucked into the kind of whole Europa League thing. I mean, I think that's just a thing of small clubs and bigger clubs. It would be a massive deal. I don't think it would be a massive deal for Manchester United if they won the Europa League. I mean, I'm not, you know, but compared to what it would feel like if Newcastle won the Europa League, for example. But I mean, I kind of regard myself as a fairly, you know, cosmopolitan sort of human being. But this is the first time I've even thought about this
this tournament. It's not just an issue of time difference. It's shoehorned into the fixture list, certainly from our fixture list. Chelsea having to play a kind of quite important game against Leeds in two days time in the League Cup. It feels like
George, I'm going to jump in there. Kind of like summed everything up there,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
you
no,
said,
like,
they're playing lower level opposition. I know it's a big historic rivalry with Leeds, but it's a freaking League Cup.
Yeah, but
it's the Sanchez Watt Cup. Right?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not a Chelsea fan, and I don't know at the start of the season how many people at Chelsea would seriously have put this down as the chance to win a major trophy.
I'll give
I might
you
be wrong.
One, the I owner. Might,
well, you know, maybe, but the way it's not something that's on, and I'm fully prepared to admit that this might be, you know, my failing as opposed to anybody else. But it's just not something that's in the consciousness. It's not something that, you know, in the way that you would chat about a great European match. Did you see Chelsea in the Champions League last night? You know, did you see that game? Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it was brilliant, wasn't it? What about him? What about that? You would talk about that. You would talk about it in the pub. You would talk about it with mates or colleagues. This is the first time I've had a discussion about this. I haven't felt compelled to watch any of it. I haven't felt, but at the same time, I recognise that if you've got 30,000 Corinthians fans going to Japan to cheer their team on, it is a big deal in the rest of the world. But it feels from the perspective of over here, not being directly connected to Chelsea, it feels like it's shoehorned, it feels like an irrelevance, and it feels like it's getting in the way of the real stuff.
Rory, how do we fix this? How do we bring cosmopolitan football lovers like George into this precious fold?
There was a suggestion, I think, in the Mail or maybe the Telegraph last week, which was...
Let's not advertise other newspapers,
I'm criticising it. Right. It should be played in Europe, as though that is the solution for everything. Just play it in Europe and we'll really like it. Because if it's not in Europe, it just doesn't count. It has to be in Europe. If you want a competition, make it in Europe. Have more European teams, maybe. What if they just got rid of all the teams from the rest of the world and just had European teams? Does that work?
That'd be pretty good, actually.
I think the fact, as Pedro mentioned, it's in Morocco... next year. Was it in Abu Dhabi last year as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think having it in the Near East or in North Africa, somewhere like that, makes more sense from a time point of view for the European market, and possibly actually for the South American market. I'm not sure. Is it better to have it in sort of Morocco or Abu Dhabi than it is to have it in Japan if it's on telly in Brazil? I think it probably is.
It's only a couple of hours ahead, isn't it? So
it's not going to be a huge difference. So I think that will improve it because it makes it more accessible. But I think it is purely and simply that there's a danger here that it doesn't really need improving for the rest of the world. The rest of the world kind of think it's fine, and it's just the English who have a problem with it. So maybe we don't need to do too much to make it better. I'd certainly have the English or the European and South American side, sorry, coming in at the start rather than in the semi-finals. I think that's always bad for a competition. The Europa League suffers from that as well. But it's not good for the integrity of the competition. So I changed that. And whether you could get more sides in it, so you maybe have two groups of four teams, something like that, that might work. I don't know, to kind of improve the competitive level.
All right, enough of that. Time for some quick hits. Manchester United rolled to a 3-1 win over Sunderland in what was probably their most convincing display of the season. Vidic is back. We get a bit of the old Phil Jones at right back and cleverly lives up to the hype. Pedro, everything clicking into place for Sir Alex?
When Nemanja Vidic is fit, I still think he's the best central defender in the Premier League, so that makes a huge difference. And injuries was the main reason why United didn't win the title last year. So I say, if they're fit, they're champions. So yes, things are clicking.
As for Sunderland, they've won twice since September. George, you wrote recently that O'Neill won't be sacked. I'm going to ask you flat out. Should he be? What's the end game here? Like, what do you think? O'Neill's going to turn them into a Europa League side?
Well, he won't be sacked. He shouldn't be. He'll get January to sign hopefully two or three players and put more of his own imprint on the team. He doesn't regard this as his team yet. He signed two players for money in the summer. This season has been worse than I think everybody anticipated, but we also have to remember, I don't think we listened closely enough to O'Neill in the summer when he basically said that struggle was beckoning. I don't think he thinks they're good enough. They've had too many good players or decent players out of form this season, but Sunderland regard him as the best fit for the club, and they don't see many other better options for them, at least out there.
Joey Barton said Adel Taarabt was useless. Harry thinks he's a genius, and he leads QPR to their first win of the season, a 2-1 victory over Fulham. Rory, quick, name three guys outside the top 10 who are more talented than Taarabt, and you can't name Suarez.
Oh, that's not fair. All right, I shall go for the dilettante, the louche, the landward Dimitar Berbatov, slightly nasty French midfielder Yohan Cabaye, and because I can't have Suarez, who would obviously be one of the three, faded shadow of his former self, Steven Gerrard. Taarabt is very talented, but it's how he applies that talent which tends to mean he's up and down, and which I think gave Barton that impression. He's a great player to watch sometimes, Taarabt, but is he reliable enough to get QPR out of the huge mess of trouble they're in? I'm not entirely sure.
Spurs defeat Swansea 1-0, but Michael Laudrup is angry because referee Mike Dean doesn't stop the game after Michu was laid out after fortuitous collision with Hugo Lloris. Pedro, in more genteel times, it was customary for the other side to put the ball out of play. But then, of course, because people cheated and feigned injury, we don't do that anymore. So he said, oh, it's all up to the ref. What in a situation like this where he doesn't do it, and maybe Michu could have been seriously injured, would you discipline Dean after the fact? Is there a better way to handle these situations?
It's so difficult, isn't it, nowadays, when players are rolling around on the floor like they've been shot, when you find out afterwards in the replay that they weren't touched. This was a situation where there was visibly a collision involving someone's head. I think that should be the exception. Every time it looks like someone has a head injury, stop play. It looked dangerous, and he looked like he was knocked out. I don't know if he was momentarily. I don't know if he suffered some kind of concussion. But I agree with Laudrup. I know why he feels upset, and it's a situation where referees should always stop play. Should Dean be disciplined? Well, if he is, then they need to find out guidelines and rules for referees stopping play, because you can't discipline one guy this week for stopping it for reason A and then reason B he doesn't.
Norwich beat Wigan, which means they've taken 22 of a possible 30 points in their last 10 games. They're seventh in the table. George, you were pally with him in his Newcastle days. Is this all down to Chris Hughton, or are Norwich simply some magical club in East Anglia where no matter who goes there, whether it's Lambert or Hughton, they'll do well? And if you were a Newcastle fan, and let's suspend disbelief for a minute, would you swap him for Pardew?
I can confirm that they're in East Anglia, because that's Anglia? Anglia. That's a fact. What he inherited was a very strong base from Paul Lambert, with a collective that was kind of built up over the past couple of years, what they've been through. He is the perfect man to add to that. It's exactly what he did at Newcastle. He's also got he's also got some good players. Very pleased to see Wes Houlihan sign a new contract this weekend. When they play well, he's usually the man that makes them tick. So there's a few things there. I wouldn't swap him for Alan Pardew simply because I don't want more managerial instability at Newcastle, because that's not the way to progress as a football club.
Oh, I love the way you got out of that one. We love Marouane Fellaini, but his triple assault on Ryan Shawcross was as bizarre as it was shameful. A bit like Mark Halsey and his assistant, who managed to not see a headbutt, an elbow, and a smack from the Everton midfielder on three separate occasions. Fellaini has apologized, and Moyes has promised to come down hard, which I personally think is the right thing to do. But Rory, just how hard should the FA be? How many games is appropriate?
Well, the estimates in the papers this morning seem to be somewhere between 3 and 9, 3 at the lower end, 9 at the higher end. I think it'll probably be more than 3, because there were 3 elements to the assault. There's certainly, to me, there's kind of 2 red card offences in there. The fact that he's apologised should maybe kind of be a mitigating factor. But the thing with Fellaini is that he is slightly... He does run that risk quite regularly, especially with his elbows. He has busy elbows, Marouane Fellaini. It is an aspect of his game, so I guess this isn't massively surprising that he kind of got into trouble. Yeah, the FA should be relatively hard, but I don't think there's any need to be overly draconian and sort of ban him for 2 months. I think that would be slightly strained. And the other thing is, should he be banned for more games than people are for racially abusing people? I'm not so sure.
Big shout out to Ryan Shawcross, by the way, for not losing his cool and turning Marouane Fellaini into a little puddle of hair.
Gabriele, one for you. I heard Jose Mourinho had a pretty tough weekend on and off the pitch. ¿Qué pasó?
Real Madrid on Sunday. Real Madrid played Espanyol. They were 2-1 up. They didn't kill the game, and they were defended horribly. And Espanyol equalized, and it was 2-2. And now they're about roughly a million points behind Barcelona. And even he has admitted it's extremely tough for them to get back into it. And remind you, in third place. But on Saturday, Mourinho decided to send one of his servants to go and fetch a journalist and take him to one side. And then Mourinho proceeded to read this guy the riot act. He didn't like some of the things that this guy had said on the radio about there being a split in the camp and whatever else. Now, I'm assuming we've all been yelled at privately by managers who didn't like things we write and we said, and we can dispute whether you're right or wrong in doing that. I do think it shows a bit of a sign of weakness from Mourinho here in the way that he did it. What was interesting, and I have a bit of a problem with, is that this journalist then took everything Mourinho told him and printed everything verbatim in the newspaper. And given that that newspaper was Marca, which is very tight with Real Madrid, you know it was done probably with the club's blessing. So, and Mourinho said a bunch of things in that, saying, like, for example, I know there's 21 players who would die for me, and there's three of them who are trying to screw me over, and so on. It's a bad situation for Mourinho to be in. I don't think it's entirely his fault, but this story's going to run and run. All right, that's all we got time for this week. It's been fun. Come find us on Twitter to share your thoughts, or email us, as so many of you do every week, at gamepodcast@thetimes.co.uk. Of course, you can go to thetimes.co.uk. You'll find news, views, web chats, blog, analysis. Monday is my favorite day of the week, not just because I get to do the Game Podcast with a very talented Chris Skinner, but because it's often a Rory Smith trifecta. I get Rory in for the podcast, even when he's when he's unwell, like today. We get to I get to read Rory's blog, and I get Rory's web chat. What could be more? Triple Rory. But of course, there's other wonderful days of the week, like the days of the week when George does his web chat, which is?
Well, usually never, but this week, Wednesday.
Exactly. It's a special week. And of course, George's blog, highlight of the week as well. We're on Twitter. It's at Calkin the Times. It's at Pedro CNN.
That
it's
is correct.
At Marcotti. I believe you're on Twitter too, Rory.
Apparently so, yeah. At Rory Smith Times.
At Rory Smith Times. There you go. So please reach out to us. We love to hear from you. Till next week. Bye bye.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.